on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
I also argue in my book that there's no conflict between ancient revelation, say, of Christian scripture, and the modern revelation of the evidence gathered in the 19th and 20th, and 20, now the 21st century. That's sometimes a sticking point for committed Christians. But many of the early researchers in the British and American Society of Psychical Research were ordained ministers and priests, and they went on record as saying they see no conflict between their faith and the evidence. Several of them say that the evidence supports and reinforces their faith. So I don't think that committed Christians have anything to be afraid of with regards to the modern evidence.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by Oxford-educated teacher and author Chris Carter to discuss his latest book, The Case for the Afterlife. Chris presents 5 lines of evidence to argue for an afterlife beyond any reasonable doubt: near-death experiences, deathbed visions, children's past life memories, apparitions, and messages from mediums. Additionally, Chris addresses common criticisms about the reliability of eyewitness testimony and anecdotal evidence. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Chris Carter is a physics teacher who was educated at Oxford, England. His previous work includes Science in the Near-Death Experience, Science in Psychic Phenomena, and Science in the Afterlife. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, The Case for the Afterlife. Chris, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Nick.
Yeah, well, thank you, and thank you for your time. I'm looking forward to speaking with you. I think just about everyone has an interest in whether or not there is an afterlife. And what you do in the book is you present the evidence for it. And I want to get to that evidence, but you do a few sort of preliminary steps before you actually begin examining the evidence. And one is, I think, really crucial, and that is that you look at the mind-body relationship. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that a little bit and why it was important to look at that and the position that you take on it.
Okay, well, I think it's important to discuss that because many of the opponents of the idea of the afterlife, they tend to be militant atheists. And one of the central pillars of atheism is the doctrine of materialism, the idea that all events have a physical cause, and that therefore the mind produces the brain. I argue in my book that the evidence suggests otherwise. The evidence suggests the mind works not as a producer of consciousness, but as a transmitter-receiver for the mind, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, other times from mind to body, as in willed action. And the important thing to remember is that it's not necessary to consider the evidence for the survival of death in order to find support of this view. All we have to do is look at mainstream medical research. It's been known for thousands of years that as patients with any sort of impairment of their brain approach death, then in the final few days, in the final few hours, they often suddenly become lucid, and they seem in every way perfectly normal. I mentioned several examples of people who suffering from various forms of brain impairment, Alzheimer's, dementia. And within the last few hours or days of their life, relatives and friends report that it's like talking to somebody who's been asleep for years or decades. And this was known by the ancients. Hippocrates talked about it, Cicero, others. And they all held a view that the brain is damaged, the soul remains intact. It's just prevented from expressing itself. And in the last few hours before death, the soul frees itself, disengages from the restrictions of material brain, and is allowed to express itself again.
Yeah, it's an ongoing problem in philosophy, you know, the mind-body problem. And now they talk about the hard conscious, you know, the problem of the hard problem of consciousness.
Well, the problem is only hard for the materialists.
Yeah, exactly.
They can't explain. They have absolutely no idea how, you know, the brain can possibly generate the mind. So it's not a hard
Right.
problem for
Yeah.
dualists to solve.
Yeah, exactly. And I've always adopted the position that you took. Actually, yours is a little bit more fine-tuned, where you look at it at the brain as receiver transmitter. But I've always thought of it as, kind of like the analogy of a radio or a television, that it's not producing the signal, it's actually picking up on the signal.
Yes,
And
exactly. But those radios and televisions are one-way transmitters. Well, they're
right.
receivers and they transmit, but they're not two-way receiver
Right.
transmitters. I argue that the brain is for the mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was the one point of difference. And I appreciated that. And I think that actually helps resolve a lot of problems that people are still gnashing their teeth over. So the other thing that I found really interesting in the book is that you're looking at the evidence. And again, we'll get to the evidence here in a moment, but you take an approach very similar to a court case where you're looking at the evidence. And I was wondering if maybe you could speak to that, the approach that you took when examining the evidence.
Yes, well, I argue in my book that the case for the afterlife has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt. People sometimes ask, or rather, so-called skeptics, materialists, sometimes say, well, there's some evidence, but it hasn't been proven. The point is that we have to be careful about what we mean by proof, because there's basically two categories or standards of proof. There's proof beyond reasonable doubt, and there's proof beyond all conceivable doubt. But as I argue in the book, the latter is only appropriate when dealing with pure logic and mathematics. Only in pure logic and mathematics can we achieve, absolute certainty or certainty beyond all conceivable doubt. I mean, the simple logical argument, if A is greater than B and B is greater than C, A must be greater than C. It's simply inconceivable that C is greater than A. But the only reason we can attain such mathematical certainty is because A, B, and C are purely abstract entities in a purely abstract argument. When we're dealing with factual matters or empirical matters, the only relevant standard of proof is proof beyond all reasonable doubt. And what that means, as I define it in my book, is that something, a statement is proven beyond all reasonable doubt, we have good reasons to believe it is true, and no good reason to believe it may be false. That doesn't mean we believe it beyond all conceivable doubt, because we can always imagine that the police framed the accused. But unless we have good reason to believe that the police framed the accused, and if we have reason to believe the police did not frame the accused in the sense that there's evidence that cannot be explained by police corruption, then the proper verdict is guilty beyond all reasonable doubt. And so I argue in my book, The Case for the Afterlife, that the case has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt, using basic legal and philosophical reasoning.
Yeah, it's the distinction between deductive and inductive reasoning. So what you're doing is you're making a strong case for the afterlife. And I think that's important, because, we've known for a long time that deductive reasoning that is based on certainty doesn't really tell us much about the actual state of the world. One of the criticisms, though, I know, and you do address this, is that anecdotal evidence is not always reliable. Because so much of this, not all of it, but a lot of this comes from anecdotal evidence. So, how do you respond to that, that we can trust the eyewitness accounts that we have?
Well, in the first place, very little of the evidence that I describe in my book depends upon eyewitness testimony. But it's basically apparitions
Yeah.
that are the result of eyewitness testimony. But the other things are not, such as the evidence from mediumship. I mean, it was standard policy of the British and American Societies for Psychical Research when they were investigating mediums to carefully record everything the medium said or wrote. Nothing was excluded. And so these records are permanent and objective. They can be examined by anybody at any time. And so the question of mistaken eyewitness testimony simply does not apply to most of the evidence that I discuss. With regards to apparitions, yes, I describe cases in which multiple witnesses sometimes have seen something or reported something, an apparition. Sometimes at the same time, sometimes at other times, animals have responded to these things. Critics sometimes say, well, we know from psychology studies that eyewitness testimony can be flimsy or unreliable, and therefore we should just, they try to justify a blanket dismissal of
Right.
all eyewitness testimony. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, you have to consider each case on its own merit. You can't just say, well, these people reported something, but we know eyewitness testimony is flimsy, so let's just reject this specific case. Each case has to be considered on its own merits. Secondly, they often point to, psychology experiments where they'll have a staged event in the classroom and then they'll gather the eyewitness testimony and they'll notice certain discrepancies, But it's important to remember that we're not looking, when we're examining eyewitness testimony, we're not looking for exactly the same testimony repeated again and again. You want different perspectives. And so you would expect differences in incidental details. Well, some person would say that the assailant fired two shots, others three shots. He had red hair, he had brown hair, he had a blue shirt, he had a green shirt. Yet they all agree that a shooting occurred. So what you're looking for is a consistent core of testimony with regards to the essential facts, even if there's some divergence on incidental details. I also mentioned how the legal system has taken a lukewarm view of such psychology experiments with staged events. And so I mentioned a case in which these two psychologists examined the case of a shooting which occurred in broad daylight in front of 15 eyewitnesses. And what they did was there was a trial and there was a conviction and what have you. And these two psychologists interviewed the eyewitnesses, 13 of the 15 eyewitnesses, several months after the trial. And they compared their testimony several months after trial with the testimony that they gave in court and with a police reconstruction of the shooting. And they completely disagreed with the negative view of eyewitness testimony. They found that the eyewitness testimony was virtually identical 5 months later to what it was during the trial, and they found that it and they dis discovered that it did indeed correspond very well with the police reconstruction of the incident using other forms of evidence, such as forensic evidence. So these psychologists and myself take issue with the essentially negative view of eyewitness testimony. It's often highly reliable, very accurate. And again, each case has to be considered on its own merits.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I think you noted something in the book that even with the differences, that we can still know that something did happen. And I think that's really important. And it always kind of rubbed me the wrong way with the skeptics just completely disregarding subjective experiences of people and saying, well, no, you can't trust what you experienced.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in science, subjective experiences may be a form of suggestive evidence.
Yeah.
There may be reason to believe it's true, but there's also reasons to believe it may be false because, after all, it's just one person's word or what have you, right? But, anecdotal reports are useful as a starting point. They're not the end all be all. They're not, you don't base conclusions on them. You use them as a starting point for more rigorous forms of investigation.
Right. Exactly. So let's look at some, you've already mentioned a few, but let's look at some of the other evidence that you examined for existence of an afterlife. So what are some of the pieces of evidence that you look at?
Well, I argue in my book that the evidence for an afterlife comes from five independent lines of evidence: the near-death experience, deathbed visions, children who claim to remember previous life, reports of apparitions, and messages received and departed via human mediums. Now, these five independent lines of evidence are all very different from each other, yet they all point in the same direction. And they reinforce each other and supplement each other. It's like a legal case in which you have eyewitness testimony, you have forensic evidence, you have physical evidence, you have circumstantial evidence, you have means, motive, and opportunity. And all these things, these various strands of evidence, I argue, converge to an airtight case.
Now, is there one line of evidence that you think is stronger than any of the others, or would you say that we have to look at all of them together?
I think we should look at all of them together. I argue in my book, The Case for the Afterlife, that the single strongest line of evidence would be what seems to be messages from the departed received via human mediums. Again, the evidence, at least in many cases, permanent objective because it was written down, every word the medium said or wrote. The question of mistaken eyewitness testimony, as I said, simply does not arise. And these messages are often highly detailed, and they show not just knowledge of the departed person's life, but they show evidence of purpose and perspective, personality, skills, even unique mental characteristics of the departed person. So, yeah, I would say that the evidence from mediums is the single most impressive line of evidence.
Okay. Can you give an example of one of the mediumistic examples that you give in the book? I seem to recall one of a chess player where the medium is showing skills in playing chess that they would not normally have had. And there were a few others, and I think, and I could be wrong, wasn't there one of someone who had been involved with, I think, like the Society of Psychical Research?
Oh, yeah, there's several such cases. Well, I'd like to talk about a case involving a New York lawyer named George Peller who was killed in an accident at the age of 32. His friend was a fellow, another lawyer named Richard Hodgson, who, despite being a hardcore skeptic who did not believe in the reality of an afterlife, joined the Society of Psychical Research as an active researcher. After his friend was killed in the accident, messages purporting to come from George Pellew began to be received through a Boston medium named Leonora Piper. Sometimes the messages were conveyed verbally, as if he were controlling her vocal cords, and other times they were conveyed via so-called automatic writing on a piece of paper. Hodgson investigated Piper, and as part of his investigation, he brought in 150 different sitters, 30 of whom had known the living Pellew. And in 29 of the 30 cases, Pellew seemed to recognize them almost instantly. And conversations were held via the medium between Pellew and his surviving friends in completely appropriate manners, appropriate to each relationship. Hodgson himself was very impressed by this manifestation of Pellew's personality, so much so that he became convinced himself of the reality. But what really was the clincher was this one case of, I mentioned one case where Pellew did not recognize someone that he had known when well alive. This was a young woman who had been a child when Pellew had known her 8 years previously. Now, under the hypothesis of extrasensory perception, that the medium is using extrasensory perception to somehow gather information about Pellew, we would predict that she would claim to recognize this young woman because sources for telepathy were readily at hand. The young woman herself knew that Pellew knew her when she was a child, and Hodgson knew that this young woman had known Pellew years ago. But instead, we have non-recognition. He basically did figure it out. The conversation, the transcript is in my book. It's very interesting. He eventually figures out that this was a young someone he had known when she was a child. He says, "My, how you've grown. How's your mother?" Things like that. But so you see, under the hypothesis of super extrasensory perception, there's no explanation for Pellew's failure to recognize the young woman. But that's exactly what you'd expect if it were indeed the living Pellew still communicating through the medium Mrs. Piper. So it's cases like that that refute extrasensory perception, even on the grounds that the medium is somehow capable of using these vast powers of telepathy and clairvoyance to gather information about the deceased. That's the most that it can explain, but it even fails, ultimately fails on those grounds.
Yeah, I'd heard of the super ESP before. One of the things that always I found kind of curious, because I've heard this from some pretty well-known debunkers, I should say, or skeptics. I don't actually like to refer to them as skeptics because sometimes they're more deniers.
But I always found it interesting that some of them would rely on this super ESP explanation, but then at the same time, they would deny ESP.
Well, you have to, there's different deniers and so-called skeptics. Many of them are hardcore materialists. They're, as again, I mentioned, many of them are militant atheists. They're opposed to anything that opposes materialism, which is one of the pillars supporting militant atheism. So these people usually resort to elaborate fraud scenarios or accusations of incompetence. Even if they don't provide any evidence for fraud or for incompetence, they just say, well, maybe for all we know, I mean, or we know eyewitness testimonies are reliable, maybe they just made it up, and they never present a shred of evidence. But, diehard materialists are not the only type of skeptic. There's also people who do accept, skeptics who do accept the reality of extrasensory perception, such as telepathy and clairvoyance. And for whatever reason, these people also do not want to believe in the existence of an afterlife, or, and perhaps more importantly, they don't want anyone else to believe in the existence of an afterlife for various reasons. Let's just say they're not the nicest people in the world. And so they resort to a hypothesis that extrasensory perception, or that the medium can somehow employ vast powers of extrasensory perception to gather information, either telepathically or clairvoyantly, from the minds of other people, even if whatever they may be thinking about at the moment, or from books and other written records, clairvoyantly. Basically, they're grasping at straws. It's the old strategy of throw anything and everything against the wall, just in the desperate hope that something will stick.
I always find it interesting because, part of my background, I've been teaching at the college level for about 20 years now. And one of the courses I teach is, well, I teach critical thinking and logic. And in the critical thinking classes, I'm supposed to cover, quote unquote, pseudoscience. And one of the textbooks has a chapter on these things. And it always, bothered me because the book just flat out states, well, there's no evidence for ESP. There's no evidence for this. There's no evidence for that, but I know that there is. And it seems to me that there's a lot of indoctrination that's going on, and it's a refusal to actually acknowledge any of the evidence that there is.
Yeah, well, my first book was titled Parapsychology and the Skeptics. It was renamed by my second publisher to Science and Psychic Phenomena. And it deals with exactly that, the nature of the controversy. As I said before, most of the so-called debunkers and the deniers are militant atheists. They've got an ideological agenda that they wish to promote. In other cases, the person is simply ignorant of the best evidence. In some cases, they're willfully ignorant. In other cases, they simply dismiss the evidence. They say, well, it's just faulty eyewitness testimony, what have you. But the reality of the situation is that surveys have shown the vast majority of scientists fully accept the reality, or at least the possibility, of extrasensory perception. I mentioned two surveys in my first book, and I don't remember the exact figures right now, but it's something like, it's approximately, two surveys were done, approximately 80% of scientists said that extrasensory perception was either an established fact or a real possibility. Most of the negative responses came from psychologists, not physicists. And when the psychologists were asked why, they'd say, well, it would turn the laws of physics upside down. But these people just don't know what they're talking about. They're thinking about the classical physics they were taught, that they struggled with in high school. They don't realize that there's absolutely no conflict whatsoever between the existence of extrasensory perception, or survival for that matter, and modern physics. And some would argue that there's no conflict at all even between the existence of these things and classical physics, the physics of Isaac Newton and James Clerk Maxwell. There's a lot of ideological issues involved here, that's for sure.
There is. And I know that, probably not all branches of psychology would refute it, but some, everything seems to be very materialistic and focused on the brain. And it always seems to me that there's often a rejection just because, and this is, pretty much what you were saying, is that it's a rejection because it doesn't fit our worldview.
Well,
But
it doesn't fit their worldview.
right, exactly. Yeah.
You shouldn't say
Yeah.
our worldview. It doesn't fit their worldview.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I meant by the R. I was speaking on their behalf. And it's interesting because I was going to ask you, and you've already addressed this, because you come at this from a background in physics. And I think the stereotype is that as a physicist, you would deny the reality of ESP or existence after death. But that's certainly not the case. So let me ask you, though, what led you to begin investigating these things?
Well, I talk about this in the prologue to my latest book, A Case for the Afterlife. I suppose it all started when I was a graduate student in England, and a friend of mine asked me to join him and three other graduate students to live in a farmhouse owned by a college just outside of town. And I hesitated. I was kind of a long haul out of town. And then he told me that the place has a ghost. So I decided, I thought this was worthy of my attention. So I visited the place and I talked to the local college carpenter who seemed to think that the place may very well have been haunted. And so I did move in for a year. Had some interesting experiences there, nothing terribly dramatic. Returned to Canada and began thinking about these experiences and started wondering if anybody else had had similar experiences. So on a trip to the library, I was surprised to find a great deal of information about this. And so I began to read. I thought the evidence was very impressive, but I also wondered if I were fooling myself, wishful thinking, that sort of thing. And so I set out to find counterarguments, dissenting views. And what I found shocked me. I was surprised by the ignorance of the so-called skeptics. I was surprised by the vehemence of their arguments. In some cases, I was just surprised by the sheer plain nastiness of these people. And I had a lengthy online argument with one of them through via email, lasted several weeks. And in the process, I gained great insight into the so-called skeptical way of thinking about these issues. And I decided that a book was needed to critically examine this and began with my first book, which I mentioned before, Parapsychology and the Skeptics. It's a critical examination of the arguments of the so-called skeptics of parapsychology. And that was followed up with another book on the near-death experience, and then a third book on the other forms of evidence for the afterlife. And now it's my fourth book, which is much more tightly focused than the first three. It puts the finishing touches on my first three books. I like to say that all my books are an attack on the skeptical fortress. But if my first three books are an armada, then this latest one is a surgical strike.
Yeah, it is. Well, and I appreciated the approach that you took because that's how one is supposed to argue, is you look at the evidence and determine whether the evidence supports the conclusion or not. It's a very reasonable approach, and it's not just, hey, I want to believe this, so believe it too, which is what a lot of the skeptics seem to take, the approach that they seem to take. So we talked about the mediums, and I know that you've talked about near-death experiences in the book. And one that you cite is one that I've heard of before. You call it Operation Standstill. And this was the patient, Pam Reynolds, who was clinically dead for, I think, close to half an hour. Is that right?
I don't remember the exact time, but yes, it was something like that. It may have been long.
And she didn't have any blood going to her brain, and her heart had been stopped. And she had this amazing experience and was able to bring back information that she should not have been able to bring back.
Yes, she reported, Jackie reported conversations in the room. Jackie reported descriptions of the instruments used and so forth. And certain medical procedures. She reported being shocked twice in order to restart her heart. She shouldn't have known that, and other things as well. She also reported traveling to another place where she met various deceased friends and relatives, had conversations with them, did not wish to return, was forced, basically forced to return by her, I think it was her uncle. And yeah, it's one of the most famous cases of the near-death experience. What's so interesting about it is that this occurred, these gives every indication of occurring during a time when Pam Reynolds was clinically dead. She had no heartbeat. She had no blood running through her brain. She had no electrical activity in her brain. She was, by all medical definition, dead.
One of the things that I know we're starting to get close to the end here, but one of the things that you do in the towards the end of the book, which I found interesting, is you take all this evidence and you know, not only are you arguing for the existence of the afterlife, but you kind of give a glimpse as to what that afterlife might be like. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that a little bit, because it doesn't seem to be consistent with, you know, a lot of the religions. It's consistent with some of them, but it also seems to be, if I remember correctly from the book, consistent worldwide.
Yeah, the evidence reported in different cultures is often very, very similar. Near-death experiences are very similar across cultures. There's some minor differences, of course, but they're very similar. Deathbed visions are very similar. Reports of apparitions come from virtually all cultures of which we have record. They come from ancient times. Reports of communication through mediums come from all cultures, virtually all cultures, virtually all times. I also argue in my book that there's no conflict between ancient revelation, say of Christian scripture, and the modern revelation of the evidence gathered in the 19th and 20th and 20 now the 21st century. That's sometimes a sticking point for committed Christians. But many of the early researchers in the British and American Society of Psychical Research were ordained ministers and priests, and they went on record as saying they've seen no conflict between their faith and the evidence. Several of them say that the evidence supports and reinforces their faith. So I don't think that committed Christians have anything to be afraid of with regards to the modern evidence.
Well, I think that one of the sticking points that you often hear is the evidence for reincarnation, because many Christians will say that that is very contrary to Christian teaching, but you don't think that it is.
No, I don't. There's at least two references to reincarnation in the New Testament. At one point, Jesus and some of his disciples come across a blind man, and the disciples ask him, Yeshua, who is it that sinned that this man is blind? Was it his parents or was it this man himself? And Jesus did not rebuke them in his reply. Now, how could this man be responsible for his own blindness, being blind from birth, other than that he sinned in a previous life? The other case was when the disciples were asking Yeshua about John and his relationship to the prophet Elijah, who's supposed to come before Jesus, or come before the Messiah. And Jesus described John as the prophet Elijah who was to come. So, and it's also important to remember that it was very common among the early Christians to believe in reincarnation. It wasn't until a council, I believe, in the fourth century, which was not called by the Pope refused to attend. It was called by the emperor himself, of the empire, the Byzantine Empire, and is believed that the edict against or making reincarnation contrary to church scripture was based on political considerations. And it should not be considered binding by Catholics because this council was not called by the Pope. As I said, he refused to attend. So I don't think there's any necessary contradiction between the doctrine of reincarnation and any religion. Having said that, people sometimes worry or they're distressed or troubled by the idea that maybe our lives are a series of endless reincarnations. Those fears are entirely groundless. The evidence indicates that most human beings reincarnate two, three, at most four times. As one person remarked, once I've learned the lessons of earth life, there's no reason to repeat them.
Interesting. I know that that's the kind of the model in Hinduism, is that it's this endless cycle of rebirths, samsara, and the main point of the tradition is to get off that wheel of samsara. So it is comforting to know that that the reincarnations are limited to, three or four. And also, I do know that the early church father Origen, I believe it was accepting of reincarnation. So it's part of the Christian tradition that's just been kind of disregarded for whatever political reasons. So you said that this book is sort of the, you had your armada, and then this is the like the kill shot, if you will. Where do you go from here?
I'm not thinking too many steps ahead at this point. This may very well be my last book on these particular subjects. Right now, quite frankly, I'm just focusing on promoting the book and trying to get the word out there.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting book and it's interesting evidence. And, one of the questions I had for you is the evidence that you give, I'm assuming that you think that is the strongest, but the evidence, it's not exclusive. So, for example, when you look at the mediums, you're giving what I assume you think is the strongest piece of evidence. Same thing with like children who remember past lives, that's the strongest piece of evidence. But it seems that it's important to keep in mind that they aren't the only pieces of evidence, that there's a lot more that can support the argument that you're providing.
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, I examined five independent lines of evidence: near-death experiences, deathbed visions, reports of apparitions, children who claim to remember a previous life, and communication from the departed via human mediums. And as I said before, these five independent lines of evidence are all very different from each other, and yet they all point in the same direction.
All right. Well, can you say where people can go to find out more about you and your books?
They can go to my publisher's website. I'm not sure if they've got anything up yet. The publisher is Llewellyn. How does it spell now? Llewellyn, I believe. Llewellyn Publishers. And and then it'll be released on Amazon early
Okay.
February.
All right. Well, I'll put a link for the book through the publisher in the show notes in the video description. I usually put links to bookshop.org versus Amazon because I like to support independent bookstores versus making Jeff Bezos any richer than what he already is. So I usually put that link in there too. So, all right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time today. I know we had a little bit of technical difficulty on my end, so I apologize for that as well. But it was nice to speak to you and hear the evidence for the case for the afterlife.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 177 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, most of you know what I'm going to say next. This is not a mystery. Please sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends and family and on social media. Subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill. The thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following are all free, and that it only takes a few seconds of your time. And it really does help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, very slow going. But your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology. Consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may it be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways. And may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.